Hi, I'm Will Beckton.
And I'm Amber Beckton.
Revenge is a dish best served cold. Same goes for gazpacho.
Welcome to Jet Road Studios Presents, where every episode is a pilot for a different show.
That's right. Today we bring you the pilot for My Life in Between, which is a collection of short stories written and performed by Lori Plager. The writing is very strong and tackles some heavy themes like dating with stage 4 cancer.
Lori actually lives across the street from us. We live in a pretty tight-knit block, as she mentions. The first time I met Lori was actually the night my father passed.
Oh, wow.
I don't think I've ever told you this story. I walked out and Lori came across the street right away. And she said, I live across the street. I just want to let you know I'm so sorry. And I said, I appreciate you saying that, but I actually don't want this to be known, like in the neighborhood. And she looked down the street and she said, we're all on a text chain. We all know.
Oh, man. Wait, this is the text chain we're now on.
That we're now on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's somebody you can trust, basically, you know?
Yeah, it's not like she's going to be like, oh, yes, of course. And then that's the end of the discussion.
Which she could have just as easily had done.
I think that normally would be what one would say.
Yeah.
But she's like, oh, no, that's not an option.
Wow, that's so crazy. And I just did not know that.
Lori's serious stuff.
Yeah.
She was an entertainment executive at places like Mattel, Activision, and Sony.
Yeah.
And also, she's funny.
We've really loved working with Lori on My Life in Between. She selected 3 stories for the pilot. So first up, we will hear Oh My God, I'm Dying, followed by Unsaid. And then the final story is called My Non-Sex Life, not to be confused with Dying for Sex.
Take it away, Lori Plager.
Jet Road Studios presents
My Life in Between.
Oh My God, I'm Dying. I found out that I was dying when I had tinfoil on my head and was under a heat lamp. I was 5 minutes into my highlighting process when the phone rang. I must have sounded distressed because some random woman came over with a box of tissues. Perhaps it clued her in when I asked my doctor, "What's the longest amount of time someone has ever lived with a diagnosis of breast cancer metastasis to the spine?" At that point, I may have been speaking in what toddlers call an outdoor voice, unsure of what to do after I hung up, because I had several minutes left before I could rinse and leave. I sat in the chair and silently cried. I didn't want to alarm anyone sporting sharp scissors. I could imagine the clients leaving the shop and calling their friends, telling them disbelievingly that a doctor had given someone the news of stage 4 cancer while getting their hair colored. Later, I wondered if my doctor had waited until late afternoon to tell me because he didn't want to, you know, ruin my day. Like it made a difference. 26 years earlier, when I was too young to have breast cancer, I had breast cancer. 13 years later, I had it in the other breast. 12 years later, after complaining of a backache, they did an X-ray. Normally, there's no possibility of a definitive diagnosis without a biopsy and a pathology report. But in this case, it was obvious. The breast cancer had metastasized to my spine. Treatable, but not curable. So I'm dying in 2 years, or 20. Or somewhere in between, I'm not sure. There is a difference between theoretical dying, because, you know, we all know it's going to happen someday, and the actual, you have incurable cancer kind of dying. When the latter is announced, regardless of how many times you've thought about how you might die, it's shocking. Now you know that unless you get hit by a bus, have a heart attack, or some other unforeseen event, this is how you are going to die, and you wish you didn't know. When I gave my then 15-year-old son the news, I followed up by telling him about a woman I found online who had a very similar case. She had already lived 18 years. 2 days later, he was annoying, argumentative, and rude. I didn't want to pull the C card this early in the process, but I was mentally spent. I asked politely if he could please be more understanding. Perhaps he could remember that I was going through a difficult time. Cocking his earbud-sporting head and barely glancing at me, while his hands remained poised on the computer keyboard, he said, You told me you had 18 years. It's been 2 days. Apparently, he took me at my word. My oncologist tells me that she has patients who have the same diagnosis that have lived for 20 years. That's 2 more than the woman I found on the online search, so hey, she must be doing something right. However, when I remind her that some have died very quickly, she says, well, we're not going to talk about them. Nevertheless, when I meet with her monthly to get blood tests, a shot, and a physical check, I ask the same question. What's her thought, timing-wise? I doubt I'm the only patient who asks this question, but since she's answered it repeatedly, she sighs in not-so-subtle exasperation. I'm sure she's tired of the query, as if she truly knows the answer, since she doesn't, and since no one does. It's been 18 months since my diagnosis, and nothing is happening. There's no growth, no spread to other organs, nada. When my back doesn't hurt, I trick myself into thinking that I am a miracle case, and it's gone. Perhaps I'll live a normal lifespan. I'm thinking I could set the record. Vegas odds for 25 years. I change my passwords to include a target 25 years into the future with the word hope attached. I buy boots that will last more than a few seasons. I stop assuming death is imminent, and I watch a lot of HGTV. I fantasize about moving to a beautiful and affordable home in another state. I toy with the idea of re-upping my membership on a dating website, but don't, because I don't know how I would explain my current situation. Is it first date conversation material? Then again, some men might enjoy the idea that I have an expiration date. It's the ultimate excuse for an uncommitted relationship. Or do I wait until we've had fantastic sex? Wait a minute. I'm not sure I want any sex. The idea of a perfect evening is snuggly pajamas, a handful of chocolate mints, a dog at the foot of the bed, and a crime show. But I digress. The point is, I have periods of time in which I suspend disbelief. When my back hurts, however, even mildly, I chide myself for that optimism. I pore over the results of my quarterly x-rays, MRIs, PET scans, CT scans, bone scans, and bone density scans. I look for the little black markers that indicate that I'm not in the normal range. I study graphs which give me indications of monthly ups and downs. Am I trending in the wrong direction? I search the internet for meaning to elevated chloride or lowered potassium. I drink tea with mushroom supplements, and I try Tai Chi at the Cancer Resource Center. I go online and I plan meaningful trips with my son, which, by the way, he doesn't appreciate. I clean out files and organize photos so I don't leave anyone with a confusing mess. I buy a nice plot in a cemetery and update my will. Recently, I had to shop for new roof shingles. The guy asked if I preferred 30-year shingles or lifetime shingles. I told him that I was over 60 and had cancer. 30-year shingles were more than enough. If he had 15-year shingles for a discount, I'd consider them. Lifetime shingles were for young couples who never thought about their lives ending. He told me, I didn't look like I was over 60. He's a good salesperson. When I'm not vacillating between the 2 and 20 year scenarios, I live in the gray zone. This is the most dangerous zone, as I've made no decision regarding when my life will end. In the middle of the night, I wake up panicked. What if they find a cure for cancer in 15 years and I've spent all my money? I'll be living in a trailer in Montana. I fucking hate the cold, and there's no good bagel places there. I'll be a burden to my family. Not like they'll visit me in Montana, but they'll hear me whining on the other end of the phone. Hold on, there's another buffalo at my door. I just don't know if I should be living like I did when I didn't know I was dying, or I should live like I only have a few years left. Could someone please supply me with an exact number so I can plan accordingly? My financial guy at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney has become an almost daily call. God bless this man who tries to balance humor and grace while looking at my investments. It's just that I hadn't planned on being unemployable 5 years before I was going to retire. There's a gap in my savings, and I don't know how to bridge it. He doesn't want to tell me to pinch pennies, nor does he want to tell me to blow it all on jewelry, shoes, and Botox treatments. Okay, I'm kidding about the latter. Well, about two of them. My son, an only child of a singular parent, drives me to live the longest life possible. Someone must keep him out of jail and love him unconditionally. Someone must make sure he gets into a good college and love him unconditionally. Yes, I've said that twice, but it bears repeating. That is the part that just crushes me. I don't want to leave my son, and I don't want him to be left. As he peruses the daily university flyers that grace our mailbox, he smiles and tells me he's going to find a school far away from me. He's only partially kidding. He wants his independence, and because I'm not lying in bed with no eyebrows and an IV bag, he doesn't fully grasp the gravity of the situation. 2 months after my most recent diagnosis, he said, "What's different?" Nothing. He thinks that I'll be there when he graduates, when he gets married, and when he has children. He doesn't realize that despite the optimistic span of time that does happen for some people, it may not happen for me, for us. I'm trying not to hold on too tight or to scare him. I want him to have a normal childhood, but I also don't want him to regret not making the most of our time together. Or perhaps that's just me, not wanting to let him go because I really want to know how his life turns out. I search for meaning. As this is my third rodeo, it's not like I haven't thought about it. The first time, I would get into the car and regularly drive to unknown spots where I was certain no one would know me. I would purchase Slurpees and walk around Target stores. If I cried in my car or in the pet supply aisle, it didn't really matter. I went to Disneyland to ride as many roller coasters as possible so I could scream without having someone call the police. I thought I could outrun my cancer, but it fucking followed me everywhere. Even when I went to small distant towns with unusual names like Azusa. The second time around, it seemed like a blip on the radar. I had done this once before, knew the top doctors, and remembered all the steps. I was practiced at navigating chemo, radiation, and evaluating the surgical options. I also knew how to manage well-meaning people who suggested curative elixirs and theories about why certain people had cancer and others did not. This third time, however, it's different because this is my last time. I will never not have cancer. I have had more than ample time to think about what kind of mark I want to leave behind, how I will be remembered. Regardless of the numerous winding paths of thought, it always comes down to the same thing. The win equates to how much love you've put out in the world. It's so corny, but it's really that simple. Be kind to everyone and every living thing. Know that no matter how little you have more than most. So share your wealth. Be sincere. And if you can, be funny. Especially in the hair salon when you have tinfoil on your head. Pretend to call a friend, then hold your sides as you laugh, gasp for air, and say, "Oh my God, I'm dying."
You just heard, "Oh my God, I'm dying." Now we will hear Unsaid.
Here's what I can't say to you. When I see you in front of the bookstore with your brother and your nephew, when you ping me on Facebook and ask me how I'm doing after we haven't spoken for 2 years, when we're at a board meeting at the synagogue and someone nominates me for the vice president role, when I'm volunteering at the snack stand at my son's school and people are talking about their children the colleges they will attend, and how they will move away from home. Here's what I can't say to you when an old work associate recommends me to a headhunter who wonders if I'm interested in a position that, ordinarily, I would love. When you tell me about any of the myriad non-life-threatening illnesses that you're encountering or have survived, a twisted ankle, too much Botox under your left eye, when you jokingly call someone cancerous. Here's what I can't say to you when I'm introduced to new people who ask what I do for a living. When parents of my son invite me to dinner for the first time and wonder what I do with my time. Am I retired? Not really. Actually, I want to say I don't have any idea what I'm doing or if I'm spending my time wisely. What I'm doing is paying bills, washing clothes, walking the dogs, searching for computer science programs for my son, and closely guarding my money because I don't know how long I'll need it, because I don't know how long I will be alive, because I have stage 4 cancer. It would be awkward, to say the least, to work it into any of these conversations. Yet, would it be better for my friends and acquaintances to find out at the bitter end? Why didn't she tell me? She's known for years. They would feel betrayed. This is why I parse out this information in increments. Some people on my tight-knit block have known since I found out 19 months ago. Yes, it's like having a toddler. I still count months until we reach 2 years. I wish I could do it all at the same time and get it over with. But the magnitude of telling people you are dying is difficult enough one-on-one. The moment I tell them, I'm forced into looking at their pained eyes, their drooping heads, their mouths that become a large O. I become the caretaker rather than the patient. It's exhausting to hold other people's pain, especially when you're the one inflicting it, even if it's not on purpose, even when it must be said at some point. There is no map, no set of rules on how to navigate this terrain. I mean, really, we are all dying. It's just that I have a very clear picture. It involves scans every 4 months, drugs being added or subtracted depending on the response, and eventually, okay, I don't even know how to end that sentence because I'm not certain which organ will fail and cause me to expire. Breast cancer metastasis to death usually involves the lungs or the liver. Right now, I only have it in my spine. Only. Imagine what it's like living with this knowledge. During the day, I can distract myself with positive thoughts and hopefulness. At night, I get real with the situation and think about how much time I've wasted, not being productive, not having made the difference I wanted to make in the world. I frequently awaken between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. thinking that I should write, organize the closet, or do anything with the time I have left. But I know sleep is essential, so I try to listen to rain sounds on my Echo and hope to drift off. It doesn't usually work, which is why I've seen every episode of Dateline, 48 Hours, 2020. I'm stuck in the unsaid, feeling like every time I see someone who doesn't know that I have cancer, that I'm lying to them, and I don't know how to fix this. What I can't say to you is that if you're a new friend, then I need you to pretend that I have all the time in the world, that we can plan things like lunches and vacations and talk about the future. What I can't say to you, that it was a pleasure knowing you, that your presence enriched my life in some small, medium, or large way. If I don't see you again, I want you to know that. What I can't say to you if you are close to me is that from time to time, I want you to ask me how I'm doing for real and be big enough to hear something that's painful. What I can't say to you is that if you think that I'm put together and beautiful or that I've been kind to you in some way or I've done something clever, that I wish you would tell me now, because time is short and you may never have that chance again. What I can't say to you is that if you were me, you would know that lots of things really don't matter. Only a few do. When you know positively that there's an end, you wonder, what was the point to all of the things that caused so much angst and pain, to all of the things that seemed so important or essential? A pair of gold earrings, the new throw at the bottom of the bed. What I can't say to you is that I am not ready to go. Not now, not for a long time. What I can't say to you is that I will be able to see my son graduate, go to your daughter's wedding, watch the country put itself back together, rejoice when they find a cure. I can't say this to you because I don't want either of us to be heartbroken if I'm not right. That is what I can't say to you.
That was unsaid. And now, my non-sex life.
Just wanted to say that, other than a fix-up with my sister-in-law, Audrey, who doesn't always have the best judgment and suggested I meet a woman as a way to expand my base, no thanks, I haven't had a date in years. Okay, well, one, Audrey arranged it. By the way, it was with a man. Sometimes I am motivated. I rush over to the keyboard and find a dating website. I sign up for one that doesn't cost anything. Within minutes, and I mean truly minutes, 20 men log on and ask if I would be interested in meeting them. I haven't even posted my picture. I'm overwhelmed. I lie down. Nope, the moment has passed. A day later, I start thinking about meeting a man from the website. He's graying and has a trimmed beard. He wears cool glasses in one of the photos. The pictures behind him portray a level of sophistication. Subtle, contrasting colors. A nubby couch. A light casts a glint on the silver-framed photos on his desk. There's a hint of a sail from a boat behind his open window. The man suggests we meet for coffee and leaves his wallet in the car. I pay. He pretends this is a one-time occurrence. I've heard that before. I look for his car in the parking lot. It has food wrappers on the seat and doors that unlock with a button that you pull up. Only the button is missing. I scour the seat for zip ties and a black hood. I want to ask to see his ID, but it's entirely possible that he's a good fabricator because he's been in jail, in the clink, in the can. Could I really tell one driver's license from another? He's irritated by my ask, but flips open his plastic wallet and shows me an Alabama license. I thought he lived in California and worked in the movie business. Why does he have an out-of-state license? Oh, he explains that short stint in Alabama. Driving through on the way to his sister's wedding, he had a one-night stand and now has a 3-year-old daughter with a woman he hardly knows. I'm captivated. I can't wait to go out with him again. He offers me a ride home. Yeah, I decline. Water anyone? So, I think I've mentioned that I haven't had a date in years except one, and no, I didn't tell him I had cancer. Not that I was trying to hide it, but because by the evening's 80% mark, I knew we wouldn't have a second date. The enthusiasm on both of our parts had fizzled. Disappointing, as he was a highly skilled texter who made me laugh with quick witticisms. He devised a getting-to-know-you game with a deck of cards, which he insisted that we play in the first few minutes. He was clever and thoughtful. However, although it was dinner time, he only drank water. I was hungry. It was a Japanese restaurant, and I ordered sushi. I thought about the Alabama man who left his wallet in the car. During the non-eating dinner, he mentioned that he had gained a lot of weight over COVID and recently lost 100 pounds. Whoa, that was impressive. But could he join me with a cup of soup? A celery stick? It was weird. I didn't hear from him again, which I had expected. Well, except maybe he texted me 3 months later and said, "Coffee?" I looked at the unfamiliar number and said, "Who is this?" And he said, I don't know, something with four letters, no last name. And I thought, who? It was a common name, like, John? I was in the middle of doing something and immediately thought it was a scam, so I never replied. Days later, I wondered if it was the sister-in-law blind date guy who didn't bother to text his last name because he figured I would know who he was because I had only been thinking about him. So who else could it be? Even though his first name was probably number 15 on the list of the most common baby names of our time, of any time, at least, that is my excuse for not answering. But if it were him, then I do feel bad because I don't want him to think I'm rude, even if I don't want to go out with him again. I'm guessing my sister-in-law ran into him and said something like, "You should call her, but take her hiking next time and bring a protein bar and water." As I painfully pay $75 for each of my son's college applications, and there are many because, well, it's not like it was when I was a kid and we applied to three schools with essays written in cursive, I think about my upcoming life. First, let me note that I have a whole spreadsheet that shows acceptance rates, submission deadlines, announcement dates, topics of essays, locations, undergrad student population, etc. If I had a full-time job in addition to this, I'd lose it. I'm already losing it. Since he's not applying anywhere within the 500-mile radius because he doesn't want me to stop by unannounced, seriously, I picture my home in September of this next year. I have one dog, who is now 14, blindish, and at the beginning of kidney failure. And another, who is 13, and barks at literally everything, and I mean air. She barks at air ferociously. She's also become very jealous of the blind dog, whom I have to pick up frequently so he doesn't bang into the wall or fall off the step. When he gets near her because he can't see her, she bares her teeth and growls. She's an animal. So my son is leaving, the dogs are in their later years, and I have stage 4 cancer. I envision a silent house filled with pieces of paper that I never filed, and I wonder if I'll die alone in the place that once had given me so much joy. I feel robbed. I thought I would retire with enough money so I wouldn't have to worry. Come on, financial aid, mama needs a new pair of shoes. I thought I would start dating again and maybe travel a bit, but the reality of either of those happening is, well, not a reality. And also, let's be real, finding someone who's interested in a relationship with someone who has a serious illness is difficult at best. And do I want to date that person? What kind of nut would they be? A fatalist for sure. People didn't even fix me up with men when I didn't have cancer. Now, layer that on top, and what are the odds? I vacillate between never to date again, which is soothingly safe, and saying, fuck it. And putting it out there on every, you know, free website. Svelte Jewish female with stage 4 cancer seeks long-term companion, with long-term in quotes. I think beginning with svelte might lure them in. So, after thinking it through, I decide I'm going to swing for the fences. Go Dodgers. After all, I'm still alive, so there's no harm in awaiting my next adventure, even if it might be brief. I scan websites that are appropriate for women my age, create my fantasy post. He's a widower, so understands what it's like to deal with death. Although, of course, we both wish his wife were alive. He's not afraid of diving into emotional muck, and he has faith that I will beat the odds. He has a wallet with paper bills and a credit card that's not maxed out. He opens the door for me naturally, like he's been doing it all his life. His kids are employed, and they don't resent me. His nails are short and clean. He smells like he just showered. He's intelligent and witty and educated. He doesn't fuss over food and is a good sport when things don't go his way. He can outthink me, and I struggle to keep up with him. But he likes me anyway. He thinks my short hair is sexy and my weight is perfect. He can't get over how lucky he is. And I feel the same way. Yep, this is the man for me. Now, I just have to find him. And I might have sex again. Yes, Audrey, with a man, damn it.
That was my life in between.
That was really great.
There was a lot that came out of that for me. I think I had an experience where a parent was diagnosed with cancer when I was about Lori's son age, and I didn't get it. And I think probably because my mom was really trying to make me feel more comfortable and not feel this dread, just as Lori's doing. And as a parent, she wants to know that her kid's going to be okay. Like, yeah. That's all you want to know about when you're a parent. And I think she describes that really well.
I don't like uncertainty or not being able to figure something out. So it's when I hear the part about her, like, can somebody please tell me, like, how much time I need to plan for? You know, like, that really stuck with me.
I actually had a conversation with her recently where I said, you know, what I think is really interesting about your stories is that it's not really motivational.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, yeah, that's not me. But at the same time, I find her writing really inspirational.
This collection of stories has to do with having cancer and dating with cancer. There's some really funny stories. You heard one of those. But then there's a whole other batch of stories that's about her son.
That was the first one that I read. And so her son actually got kicked out of his middle school for hacking into their computer system.
Oh, it was middle school?
It was middle school.
That's amazing. Her son is very smart.
Yeah.
There was one day I came home and I was excited to open up a Ivy League recruitment letter that I realized quickly wasn't for me. It was for him.
Yeah, sorry, babes.
I was like, okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to Jet Road Studios Presents. Please rate and review the show on places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
We are Jet Road Studios on Instagram and YouTube. You can also check out jetroadstudios.com, where you can sign up for the mailing list and check out the relatively new merch page. We got some merch. If you'd like to get in touch with Lori Plager about her future endeavors and her plans with her writing, you can email her at mylifeinbetween.podcast@gmail.com. I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Thank you so much, Lori Plager, for sharing your writing with us. We'll see you soon.
Jet Road Studios, where it's always pilot season.